Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
All right, so what do you call the nearly $4 trillion budget the president released this morning? How about a pretty nice place to start negotiations? How about that? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Squarespace.com, an easy way to publish a high-quality website or blog. For a free trial, go to squarespace.com/marketplace.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Monday today. This one is the 14th of February. Good to have you with us. The president's fiscal 2012 budget does take a couple of whacks at the ever-growing federal deficit, as everybody promised it would. The White House claims it'll trim $1 trillion from the deficit in the next 10 years. But for the most part, the nearly 2,500 pages that the administration takes to explain how it's going to spend $3.7 trillion in the next fiscal year, it's kind of a big yawn. And Marketplace's John Dimsdale explains that's entirely the point.
Yes, the budget freezes domestic spending for 5 years. It does cut home heating aid for the poor and raises interest rates on student loans. But there's no fix for the big deficit generators like Medicare, Social Security, or tax loopholes. President Obama says he'll only go so far.
While we are absolutely committed to working with Democrats and Republicans to find further savings and to look at the whole range of budget issues, we can't sacrifice our future in the process.
Obama's budget director, Jack Lew, was asked why the budget doesn't reflect some of the dramatic entitlement and tax reforms recommended by the president's deficit commission last December.
I would say history is a pretty good guide.
Lew knows from experience that being first with a bold, specific plan only sets up a big target for the political opposition. The road to a grand compromise is for each side to stake out a position, declare an impasse, and then meet behind closed doors to come up with something everyone can back. Stan Collender watches the budget for Corvus Communications.
The president probably looked and said, well, I'm not going to go first here. I will propose those things that are relatively safe, although he's taking a lot of heat from both sides for even those things. And then the bigger, more difficult questions we'll have to do together, or it won't get done at all.
Collender says it may take a government shutdown before leaders see the necessity for really getting down to business. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Part of what the health care law was supposed to do is to get insurance coverage for more people. That idea has triggered a rash of takeovers in various parts of the health care industry. Today, the country's biggest provider of ambulance services announced it's agreed to a $3.2 billion buyout from a private equity firm. That company, Emergency Medical Services, you've seen their vans, I'm sure, is also a major manager, as it happens, of emergency room doctors. Our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon, explains the recent medical mergers.
Investors looking for good returns have been piling up loads of cash in recent years, and lately that money is being directed at what's increasingly seen as an attractive and even willing target. Brian Tankielet is a health sector analyst at Jefferies & Company.
There's uncertainty that's driving fear, especially among the smaller providers. And so the larger guys are saying, let's take advantage of this small window of opportunity and put deals together.
The worry that he speaks of is in large part fear of the unknown. Don Brock watches the health sector for Kaufman Brothers. She says there's still lots of uncertainty over how the healthcare overhaul will be implemented in the next few years.
Everybody's trying to figure out how best to position themselves for that, how to consolidate strategically, make sure that they've got the size, the scope, the scale.
Size matters a lot because insurance companies stand to gain a mass of new customers and thus wield new bargaining clout against providers. Again, analyst Brian Tankielet.
I mean, if you're part of a five-doctor physician practice group in a hospital, you don't have any leverage. You're going to eat you alive. They'll say, here's what we're paying. If you don't want it, we'll walk away and give it to another doctor.
But analyst Don Brock isn't worried the big might grow to become so powerful they could capture too much control.
What you're talking about is private equity guys or some of the larger companies trying to get bigger, but by no means are the numbers big enough to take over an industry, not in healthcare.
As Brock sees it, the health sector is just too big to control when it makes up 17%+ of the country's whole economy. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, nobody cared about the president's budget. Not equities, not bonds, not nobody. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We'll be right back. The Egyptian army is moving right along and trying to get that country past the last 3 weeks. Generals met with protesters today to talk about constitutional reforms. The Supreme Military Council said it wants an end to the strikes that have broken out since the revolution started. But once the political details get hashed out, attention is going to turn to the economy and how to get it started again. That could be tricky for the army to do since it's doing just fine economically the way things are right now. Michael Wahid Hanna is an analyst at the Century Foundation. Michael, it's good to talk to you.
Thanks for having me.
So this seems to be a simple but somehow apropos question. How much does the Egyptian army really know about running an economy?
Well, they have vast economic holdings themselves, but obviously they are not in a position to decide macroeconomic decisions. And so one big question, and it surrounds this whole transition, is what role is the military going to play? Are they trying to consolidate and entrench military power across the board of the government? Do they actually want to run the country? Or, as many Egyptians hope, are they in a position now to lead a transition to a civil-led government?
You were in Cairo earlier this month, right?
I just got back this weekend.
So tell me how the army manifests itself in the economy. How do you know? What do you see?
Well, I mean, a lot of this is an open secret in Egypt. They have vast economic holdings. They own land. They're in construction, they're in consumer goods, automobiles, things that are far removed from any possible relation to military industry. And they employ many people. There are estimates that this could be as much as 10% of the official Egyptian economy. These aren't things that are discussed widely in Egypt. This is something of a taboo topic. The exact parameters and dimensions and scope of the Egyptian military's holdings is something that you have to read between the lines.
I imagine being as entrenched as the military is in the economy, they have certain structural benefits, right, with tax rates and employment and all that stuff.
Sure, their workers can't strike. They don't pay corporate taxes. They're able to acquire property at vastly reduced sums. They're able to employ their own soldiers at times as labor. And so they have all these institutional advantages that make their economic enterprises very lucrative.
Is it a well-run bureaucracy, or is it creaky and old and not incredibly efficient?
Well, much like the rest of the Egyptian economy, it has major inefficiencies. One big challenge is that much of the resentment among the Egyptian protesters has been against the crony capitalism that has taken place in recent years. And this was something that grew up around young businessmen that were associated with Gamal Mubarak.
Hosni Mubarak's son, we should say.
Yes, exactly. But there is a bad taste in many people's mouths around the notion of economic liberalization. It's gotten a bad rap, and now it's become associated with corruption. And so there isn't a mood in the country writ large to try to liberalize the economy. In fact, now many of the strikes going on are by state workers demanding higher pay and better conditions.
Do you have any sense that the military would be open to economic reforms, given that they are so deeply entrenched in the economy to their apparent benefit?
Well, I think the opposition in this transition period is probably not going to be focused on the military's economic holdings. I think much more likely is a focus on the political side of the equation, and recognizing that the military is in a very strengthened position now to protect those interests. And so I think if you're looking to carry the day with the military in terms of convincing them of the necessity of transitioning to a civilian-led, pluralistic, open political process with free and fair elections, the focus is going to have to be on the high-level politics, on rewriting the Constitution, and putting in place a credible plan for transition. And I don't think you're going to see much made at this point of the economic holdings of the military, because you need their cooperation to make a move toward a credible political transition.
Michael Wahid Hanna, he's a fellow at the Century Foundation in New York City, just back from Cairo. Michael, thanks a lot.
Thanks very much.
One more thing about Egypt before we move on. This afternoon, the Egyptian army asked the U.S. government to freeze the assets of certain Egyptian officials. No explicit mention of Hosni Mubarak's name, had you been curious. The events of the last couple of weeks in the Middle East have been amazing to watch. Many would call it exhilarating. Others, though, would say it's been a good reminder that you have to be ready for anything. Even before they set up shop, American expats and their corporate employers in the Middle East knew it was a volatile place. Early 2011 has them checking their contingency plans. As Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports now from Amman, Jordan.
Jonathan Hankin used to be a manager for FedEx in northern Minnesota. About 6 years ago, he and his family traded the Midwest for the Mideast.
Wanted to always have a business and move overseas, and this seemed like the safest place in the Middle East.
Now he runs a company called From the Earth in the outskirts of Amman, Jordan. He sells a mix of locally made products, jewelry, greeting cards, olive wood ornaments, through a small shop here. You can also buy his stuff online in the U.S. He says he's really focused on his business right now, but it's impossible to ignore what's happening next door in Egypt. There have been protests in Amman, though nowhere near like in Tunisia or in Egypt. But Hankin knew where he was going. Jordan is relatively stable, but it does have its problems, like high unemployment and lots of poverty.
For the most part, it's anticipated that things are going to always change here. And so for us, turmoil in the region, I think, is normal.
Which is why having a contingency plan is a normal part of doing business here, whether you're a small businessman like Hankin or a big multinational company like Coca-Cola or Citibank, American Express or Google. Walter Ulmer helps companies protect their interests in potentially volatile areas and plan what to do when things go wrong. The first priority is to protect people. Then there's the question of the bottom line.
And then also, what's the impact on our business operations? Do we have production facilities in there that are being impacted? Do we just have sales and marketing offices?
And the contingency plans have to reflect the company's priorities. In Hankin's case, he's determined to keep the business running no matter what. So he's given power of attorney to his Jordanian lawyer, just in case. He says Jordan is home now, and he really has no intention of leaving. But the last couple of weeks have made him think.
Well, we talked last week when this happened, our family, just like, you know, we hope nothing ever happens here like that. And it was really, it came down to depending on the circumstances. Because, I mean, if war broke out and, say, Syria or somebody attacked Jordan, that limits your options.
Part of their new plan is to track down important papers and set up a meeting spot. But he hopes they'll never have to use it. In Amman, Jordan, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Coming up,
it's so expensive to cross illegally that people come once and stay here. And it's easier to bring your family than it is to make return trips.
Legal immigration or illegal, the cost-benefit analysis. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials dipped 5 points today, a fraction of 1%, closed at 12,268. The NASDAQ picked up 7 points, 0.25%, 28.17. The S&P 500 tacked on 3 points, also 0.25%. 1332 at the bell. Financial shares were kind of mixed. Bank of America deposited 0.8%. Shares of Citibank added 0.6% to the asset column, but investors withdrew 0.5% from Morgan Stanley. Shares of Chevron bubbled up 1.25% despite being hit with an $8 billion fine. A judge in Ecuador said the company was responsible for oil contamination in that country. Chevron called the ruling illegitimate. Shares of GE brightened more than 0.75% after the company took steps to expand its oil and gas business. Elsewhere, investors discounted shares of Walmart by more than 1.5% after analysts said the retailer could lose market share. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.62%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Squarespace.com, an easy way to create and manage a high-quality website or blog. Visit Squarespace.com/Marketplace and sign up for a free trial. Then choose a design and color scheme that's uniquely you. That's Squarespace.com/Marketplace. We thank Squarespace for their support.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on retail sales for the month of January. The National Association of Home Builders releases its monthly report on builder confidence in the single-family housing market. And Secretary of State Hillary Clinton speaks on internet freedom at the George Washington University. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The tech world is looking more and more bubbly these days, and we're not talking the happy champagne kind of bubbles on this Valentine's Day either, folks. Kleiner Perkins, the big-name venture capital firm, took a stake in Facebook today that values that company at $52 billion. There are reports that Twitter could fetch $10 billion. Zynga, the maker of Farmville on Facebook, maybe $7 billion. There's talk J.P. Morgan Chase is going to start a fund to get its clients a piece of all that tech action. But at this rate, is there going to be any action left to be had? Our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore reports.
Many people fear that there's a tech bubble and it's going to pop. But banks like J.P. Morgan are reportedly considering jumping right in, with plans to help clients invest in tech companies. Proceed with caution, says Ethan Kurzweil, an investor with Bessemer Venture Partners.
Certainly in terms of permeating this sort of public hype, we're at a peak.
But it's not like the last tech bubble. The new twist here is that hot companies aren't even on a stock exchange.
There's just an inherent level of risk in making that kind of investment that you don't really know what's going on in the same way you would in a public company.
Paul Kodrowski, who also invests in tech companies, says the high prices grab headlines, as they have with Facebook. But unlike last time, a lot of tech companies like Groupon have profits to support the investor enthusiasm.
Strange sort of bubble where credible companies are actually getting high valuations. That's not such a terrible thing.
He says many investors are willing to pay up to get behind the velvet rope and get an inside track on a hot company that will one day go public. For those that missed out on tech riches over the past 3 years, paying up big dollars for a Facebook stake now can be worth the cost. It's an image thing.
This isn't about bargain hunting. This is really different than buying a Super Bowl ad.
Of course, it may be a different story when the hype dies down and investors don't make as much money as they expected. Then we might hear some complaints to replace the cheering. I'm Heidi Moore in New York for Marketplace.
We are all no doubt familiar with Google and its search engine. The company says it gets a billion searches a day, and generally speaking, the Google methodology seems to work out pretty well. But that system can be gamed. As New York Times business reporter David Siegel pointed out this weekend, when he noticed that until very recently, when you search for all sorts of things, from dresses to jeans to tablecloths, the first retailer that popped up was JCPenney. And it happened again and again and again. So we called him up to talk about it. David, it's good to have you with us.
It's nice to be here.
Seems to me the place to start is with a definition of how a good, normal Google search works. Once you type something into that box, what happens?
Well, what Google does is they measure the popularity of your website by essentially counting the links to your website from other websites that are typically associated with the same topic. So if you have a website on, say, folding paper airplanes, the more people who are aficionados in the art of folding paper airplanes that link to your website, the higher your website about folding paper airplanes will rise in Google's rankings. That's the way it's supposed to work.
And in fact, what happened with this JCPenney incident is this thing that you called black hat optimization, really. Tell us how that works.
If you think of the way it's supposed to work as a form of voting, then what happens with black hat is essentially vote rigging. JCPenney or someone working on its behalf established thousands of links related to dozens of different search terms and set up those links on websites around the world. So there are, for instance, 2,015 different pages that had links to JCPenney's dresses page. And in fact, JCPenney ranked number one for several months for the search word dresses.
We should point out that JCPenney has denied this to you. They said we didn't do it. But you found some websites out there with these JCPenney dresses links on them that were pretty obscure and fairly random.
Totally random. This was the strangest thing about this as I sort of waded into it. There was a casual dresses link on nuclearengineeringaddict.com. There was casinofocus.com, dentist websites. Tons of them seem to be completely abandoned.
This is not, you know, kosher in the land of search engine optimization. But did Penny get in trouble with Google because of this?
They did. So I presented all of the evidence of this campaign last week to Google, and they quickly determined that this violates their guidelines. What they did was something called manual action, which means instead of changing their algorithm, which would change results for everybody using the same strategy, someone in Google went through and by hand essentially demoted JCPenney in dozens and dozens of searches. So it had just been buried. And it was kind of humbling to see just how much power Google wields in the realm of e-commerce.
Not that this is any of my business, but were you just randomly searching for dresses and bed linens on Google one day and noticed that everything was coming up JCPenney?
No, a reader noticed. A reader who is in the retail business, although not in a field that is a competitor to JCPenney, he actually makes signs of all things and just had taken an interest in the world of search engine optimization and had noticed that there were three or four of these anomalous results. And I thought it was very peculiar, and then found a guy, Doug Pierce at Blue Fountain Media, who did an incredible job of just sort of sleuthing through exactly what had happened.
David Siegel, he's a business reporter at the New York Times. David, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Customs and Border Patrol gets a slight FY12 bump in the president's budget that came out this morning. In all, about $12 billion to make sure only what and who are supposed to be in the country actually gets into the country. But in the debate about illegal immigration, often lost in the mix, are stories of foreign workers who are here legally. More than 150,000 people come to the United States on what are called H-2 visas every year. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler went down to Mexico to check out the guest worker program from the other side of the border.
44-year-old Tomasa Guerra travels a long way for work. Her home is here in Cadereyta, Mexico, about 200 miles south of the border. But for several months each year, she works in Texas.
Nos dijeron que en marzo íbamos a regresar.
She says she'll go again in March, her ninth trip, all legal. She fills one of those jobs Americans say they don't want, in this case as a maid for a big hotel chain. The catch is these jobs are temporary, lasting from 2 to 11 months tops. U.S. companies can only hire from abroad after they've advertised and made an effort to hire locally. Texans might hold out for something more stable. But for Tomasa, $8.50 an hour beats what she earns cleaning rooms back home.
Oh, es por 4 horas, 120 pesos.
In Mexico, she makes $2.50 an hour. It's her U.S. job that pays for the one-bedroom apartment in Cadereyta and college tuition for her daughter, Yesenia. She's studying to be an accountant.
I could probably earn more money working in the U.S., but I'd rather work here because I'd have more job security. It wouldn't be temporary. It would be permanent.
Because of the money her mom makes in the U.S., Yesenia can climb up the economic ladder to a career where she won't have to leave Mexico. Unskilled workers who want to leave come here to the U.S. consulate in Monterrey, Mexico's third largest city. Hundreds line up in the cold for official permission to work in the U.S. The visa itself costs $150, and that's just part of the investment poor folks make to get these jobs. A TV soap opera blares in this migrant hostel near the U.S. consulate. At $5 a night, it's a bargain. But even pinching his pesos, Fausto Hernan spends about $700 just to get to Texas. For the past 4 years, he's mined rocks for garden decorations. If his contract runs 9 months, he can save thousands of dollars. But if the contract only lasts 2 months, he won't make enough to cover travel expenses. He says even if he loses money, he improves his chances of being rehired in the years ahead.
It's better for us to go legally. If we have papers, we can return and spend time with our families. So we prefer to go and then come back.
Still, many Americans worry that legal workers won't want to return to Mexico.
Our people, they don't want to stay in the United States to live. They just want to go to work and come back with their families.
That's Alejandra Ocadiz. She directs the Migrants Attention Center, an innovative program funded by the state of Nuevo León. Her office helps workers find jobs in the U.S. If men don't want to come back, she calls their wives, who often have the last word. If that fails, consultant Carlos Ocadiz gets tough.
We let them know 15 days before their contract finish, they need to return to Mexico. If they don't do, we are the first ones to let the U.S. consulate know so they can be cut.
legal workers have a financial incentive to return to Mexico. If they play by the rules, they may have more opportunities to work in the U.S. And going legally is cheaper. These days, getting smuggled across the border illegally costs up to $3,000. So undocumented workers have to stay longer and earn more to cover expenses. Mark Rosenblum is a senior policy analyst with the Migration Policy Institute.
It's so expensive to cross illegally that people come once and stay here. And it's easier to bring your family than it is to make return trips.
This issue of temp workers, both legal and illegal, is itself temporary. Demographic trends suggest that in 30 years, Mexico will have more jobs than people. At that point, Mexico and the U.S. will likely compete for unskilled labor. In Monterrey, Mexico, I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
This final note today from the Marketplace desk of, I haven't gotten my wife anything yet for Valentine's Day, and I don't think I'm going to either, just on principle. The National Retail Federation says the average person will shell out $116.21 on Valentine's Day merchandise this year. $116. That's up almost 18% over last year. And honestly, I just object. So you know where to send your nasty notes telling me I'm unromantic. It's letters at marketplace.org. But really, I'm not a bad guy. Anyway, that's Marketplace from American Public Media. That's APM. Today, the Dow dipped 5 points, a fraction of 1%. The NASDAQ picked up 7 points, a quarter percent. The S&P 500 tacked on 3 points, also a quarter percent. Our producers include Avishai Artsy, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. I'm romantic sometimes. I mean, seriously. Anyway, next time on this show, if Facebook and Twitter are how you start a revolution, how do you stop one?
Let's give the people money. The people will be calm and they are not going to question our authority. They are not going to talk about their basic freedoms.
Dissent meets cold hard cash. I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.